Our headlines: the Israeli regime targets areas in central and coastal parts of Syria with deadly airstrikes. Tehran condemns Washington's sanctions on officials and reporters of Iran's broadcasting organization as another example of the blatant violation of Iranians' rights by the U.S. Also, Moscow accuses Kiev of committing war crimes by executing more than 10 Russian soldiers after they surrendered. Israel has conducted fresh air attacks on Syria, killing 4 soldiers and wounding another. The attacks hit several locations in central and coastal areas of Syria. They were carried out from the direction of the Mediterranean coastal city of Banias in northwestern Syria. Material damage was caused too. It wasn't immediately clear whether the raids were airstrikes or missile attacks. The Tel Aviv regime time and again conducts air attacks on Syrian soil, despite repeated calls by Damascus to stop them. Syria says the attacks are in violation of its sovereignty. It has frequently called on the UN to force the regime to stop the strikes. A terrorist attack in the city of Izeh in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan has claimed the lives of several people. Mourners from all over the province attended the funeral procession, calling on authorities to bring the perpetrators of the attack to justice. Mahdi Abbasian reports from Izeh.
An incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Izeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the U.S. and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Izeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in Izeh terrorist attack have been detained. 7 people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from 2 directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
As they said, the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shah Cheragh, Isfahan, and Izeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Izeh, Khuzestan.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has condemned the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting officials and reporters. Nasir Kanani says this is another example of the blatant violation of Iranians' rights by the U.S. Khamenei says the U.S. is preventing the views of the Iranian people from being heard around the world. He says this is why it allows various co-op terrorist networks and media to commit malicious acts against Iran. According to the Iranian official, this shows that the U.S. has no plans to end its crimes against independent countries. The U.S. sanctions target the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, as well as its deputy for world services, which also doubles as Press TV chief. The European Union and Canada have also imposed sanctions on Press TV. The bans are part of wider sanctions targeting Iranian officials and entities over alleged human rights violations following recent riots in Iran. Tehran has strongly rejected those claims and slammed the bans as a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. Author and journalist Arnold August says the U.S. is in no position to lecture Iran on human rights.
Iran TV, I think, is succeeding in carving a place for itself in the international media to give a voice to people, not only in Iran, but elsewhere in the world, who want to tell the truth what is happening in Iran and the international situation, especially the unjust sanctions and the ongoing attempt by the United States and its allies, such as Canada, for regime change in Iran. How the United States gives itself the right to interfere in any country of the world that refuses to bow down to the U.S. dictates. The latest victim is Iran, not the first time. And imagine the United States, who is known worldwide as a country that suppresses freedom of speech. We have the example of Julian Assange. There are hundreds of political prisoners in the United States because of their ideas. And the United States is going to lecture Iran about freedom of speech? Is there a country in the world that has violated more human rights in so many places in the world than the United States of America, including in its own country, having established the United States based on the genocide of the native peoples in the United States, as well as carrying an ongoing war against the black people in the United States and upholding slavery now in a disguised form, and they are giving lessons to Iran about human rights? Come on now. How many countries have the United States invaded, killed, displaced people? Iraq, Afghanistan. Oh, we'd not forget Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Vietnam. There are so many examples. This country has a right, the United States has a right to lecture Iran and anything, especially on violation of human rights.
The U.S. government's immunity recommendation for the Saudi crown prince 4 years after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi has been met with widespread fury. During our news review program, we'll discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Here where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the U.S. government is recommending that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman be immune from accountability over the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The move has sparked criticism inside and outside the U.S. In the U.S., an NGO called Dawn says Americans can now expect bin Salman's attacks against their fellow citizens to escalate even further. Khashoggi's fiancée has also expressed outrage, saying that he has been murdered once again. International rights bodies have called the U.S. move a deep betrayal. The recommendation was issued in response to a court request asking the U.S. government for its opinion. The White House argues that bin Salman is the head of government following a royal decree earlier this year and can therefore have total immunity. Khashoggi was brutally murdered at the Saudi consulate in Turkey. According to U.S. intelligence assessments, bin Salman ordered the killing. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Colin Campbell, who's joining us from Washington. Also, we have writer and political analyst Saeed Shahab, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Colin in Washington. Walk us through exactly what took place as, first of all, the court made the order and it asked the U.S. government for its recommendation. How did this all come together?
Well, what happened was they filed the appeal and what they from the U.S. government. And this was made late Thursday night. This appeal was filed. And really what it outlines is the power that the head of state in Saudi Arabia holds in reference to any type of repercussions of the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And again, this is part of the political maneuver on behalf of the U.S., possibly to show some type of overture for Mohammed bin Salman, because of the fact that there have been eroding relations between both nations. So this is the most recent ruling. This doesn't mean that the U.S. is giving up its attempts to try to, what it says is find justice in the death of Jamal Khashoggi, but what it does is it pushes out the Saudi Arabia's head of state as far as consideration for any type of punishment or repercussions in Khashoggi's death.
Saeed Chaabi, how hypocritical is this decision?
Well, it is a representation of deep moral and ethical crisis in the modern world, in the world of diplomacy, in the world of international relations. Because here we have a killer, according to the CIA papers. They themselves think that it is highly likely that he had been involved in the planning, in the giving the orders, and executing the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October 2018. So it is only 4 years ago that the crime had been committed on a diplomatic land, on a diplomatic headquarters. Yet the U.S., which appeared to be very much against that crime, now is backtracking, and they are saying that let us give him immunity. If you give immunity to killers, regardless, the position, the status of any person should not be used as a justification for the crimes he or she commits. No, a criminal is a criminal, whether he is a head of state or if he is a cleaner in the street. The crime is a crime. The victim is the victim. And the nature of what he had committed remains, that it is a brutal killing of an innocent man, in this, not in the street, not by an unknown person, but in a consulate, in a diplomatic place, on the orders of a highly placed political figure. Yet the U.S., which is supposed to be protecting human rights, to be defending human rights, to be promoting democracy, it is putting its material interests above its principles. And that is a very serious backtracking on one of the most fundamental requirements of a responsible state.
And also, I want to get your thoughts on some of the reactions as well. International rights bodies have called the U.S.'s move a deep betrayal. What can you add to that? Mr. Chaabi, this is for you.
Sorry, this is for me. I don't know how Mr. Biden would be able to look in the eyes of Mr. Khashoggi's fiancé and tell her that, look, I have betrayed you. I have given up the case against the killer of your husband. How is Mr. Biden, how is the U.S. going to justify this in the eyes of the international law, at the Human Rights Council? How is it going to, what is going to say to the hundreds and thousands of people who are threatened with similar treatment in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain? These killers must not be given the red carpet. Instead, they must be brought to justice and the question that asked for their crime that they have committed against innocent civilians.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Colin Campbell, our correspondent, joining us from Washington. Also, thanks to writer and political analyst Saeed Chaabi, speaking to us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Russia has accused Ukraine of war crimes over what Moscow calls execution of several soldiers after they surrendered. The Russian Defense Ministry says nobody can paint the murder of over 10 restrained Russian soldiers as a tragic exception. This comes after footage circulating on social media allegedly showed the summary execution of Russian servicemen. The defense ministry says the videos are new evidence on the massacre of unarmed Russian prisoners of war. It says Western backers of Ukraine are turning a blind eye to its military abuses. Meanwhile, Russia's Human Rights Council says it will ask for an international investigation. Earlier this week, a UN report accused both Russia and Ukraine of abusing and torturing prisoners of war. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier from Donetsk for more on the alleged execution of the Russian soldiers. Take a listen.
Ukraine continues to cross the boundaries of what's seen as acceptable by civilized states. While NATO countries continue to say that extremism within Ukraine is Russian propaganda, it's very clear that it's not. Remember, some time ago, a former British soldier who was serving as security for journalists in Libya told me that if it's dark and there's a wounded combatant, you just pop him off, in his words. So these war crimes happen within most armies, but this video and others like it are crossing the boundaries. And they're not only executing these soldiers, but they're also posting these videos online. And these are the kind of images that I'm reminded of in what happened in Syria with ISIS. Of course, ISIS or Daesh, a genocidal terrorist group which would execute soldiers and video it and publish them online. So this won't be the last accusation of war crimes against Ukraine almost on a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis. We have this evidence of Ukrainian war crimes, which is usually said to be Russian propaganda, but it's very hard to keep accusing these stories of being Russian propaganda when the Ukrainians are openly flaunting their human rights abuses.
The U.S. is bracing for more drawn-out legal battles involving Donald Trump, with the Justice Department naming a special counsel to investigate the former president. The U.S. Attorney General says the appointment of Jack Smith is in the public interest because Trump has announced his intention to run for president again in 2024. The probe will look into Trump's handling of sensitive documents as well as his involvement in the 2021 Capitol riot by his supporters. Trump has dismissed the appointment of a special counsel as political and unfair. He has already been investigated by a special counsel over obstruction of justice and possible election collusion with Russia, but no charges were brought against him. The former president has also been impeached twice, but acquitted on both occasions. That's a wrap with this hour's World News.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Acts of violence and vandalism by Israeli settlers targeting Palestinian properties are routine in the West Bank throughout the year. Reports of acts of violence and vandalism against Palestinians are also rarely prosecuted by the Zionist regime forces. Olive trees are an indispensable source of revenue for many Palestinians. particularly in the West Bank, and acts of vandalism are a deliberate attempt to stifle their means of income. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The olive harvest season in Palestine has started. For Palestinians, the olive harvest is not just important for the local economy, but is a national event expressing unity, social cohesion, and defiance of the Israeli regime occupation. The Zionist regime often erases ancient olive groves in the occupied Palestinian territories to build illegal Jewish settlements, confiscate Palestinian land for whatever military purpose, or simply break the spirit of ordinary Palestinians. This is why the olive harvest is an important Palestinian occasion to send a message back to the Zionist regime that the relationship with their land is as strong as ever." Meanwhile, the website of the Electronic Intifada on the Zionist regime's settlers' attacks on Palestinian farmers wrote, "Feroz Youssef is taking all the precautions he can to fend off ever more aggressive settler attacks on his land west of Salfit in the occupied West Bank. The farmer 37 has already seen his land, 30,000 square meters outside the town of Azavia, divided into two by Israeli regime separation wall, where it dips deep into the West Bank, southwest of Nablus, in the Salfit Governorate. Never peaceful settlers from the nearby settlements of Ariel, Alei Zahav, Pudul, and Barkan have been acting even more aggressively over the past several months. Last year, according to the UN, Palestinians in the West Bank had to endure the highest recorded levels of settler violence in recent years. Fearing for his safety as well as his livelihood, Youssef has constructed a wooden hut on top of one of his bigger olive trees. The hut is about 5 meters squared and is built on the tree trunk, some 3 meters up. It is outfitted with plastic windows and boasts a sheet metal roof. A single solar panel provides electricity. Inside, there are chairs, covers, and bedding, enabling Youssef to stay overnight on his land. This serves two purposes. He can keep an eye on his land at night, and he is not subject to the capricious moods of Israeli troops at checkpoints to reach his land in the mornings. Youssef is by no means the only farmer to come up with this idea. He estimates that around 230 other local farmers have built huts on their lands for the same purpose. He fears, however, that the Israeli military might come and destroy the hut, as has happened to others. Settlers are wreaking havoc in small communities around the West Bank. Hardly a day goes by without some reports of cars being vandalized, civilians being assaulted, or trees being targeted. There are more than 280 settlements in the West Bank, outside of East Al-Quds. These are home to some 440,000 settlers, lured there by tax breaks and other financial incentives offered by the Zionist regime. Some 150 of these are so-called settlement outposts, attracting more extreme elements among the settlers. Some of these outposts are being legalized to become full settlements. A third of the outposts were established over the last decade. all pose a threat to the security of Palestinians in the vicinity, and the Zionist regime military is another source of danger for farmers and others. At least 26 children have been killed by troops or settlers this year alone. Most settler attacks take place in Area C. Some 60% of the occupied West Bank, which is under direct Israeli regime military and administrative control. Youssef Farm is in Area C, where the Zionist regime apartheid system is quite brazen. Israeli settlers are treated as civilians under Israeli law, while Palestinians like Youssef in the same area are subject to military rule. There is little to no protection for Palestinians in Area C or anywhere else. The military does not have the authority to intervene against settlers since they are seen as civilians. It is a fine distinction that B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, calls meaningless. Settler violence, the group holds, is a form of government policy, and troops almost never have to face any consequences for their actions. According to another Israeli rights group, Yesh Din, in the years 2019 and 2020, the Zionist regime military received a total of 273 complaints related to violations committed by troops against Palestinian civilians. Of these complaints, just 56 investigations were opened, or about a fifth of all complaints submitted. Yesh Din attributed the small number of opened investigations, a number that is decreasing year on year, to a deliberate policy to raise the threshold for opening criminal investigations. Ultimately, the group found only 2% of complaints resulted in prosecution. Ahmad Al-Mahmoud, 66, from Kafar al-Dik, further west from Salfit, suffers constant vandalism by settlers from the nearby Al-Izahaf settlement, to which he has already lost 6,000 square meters of his 13,000 square meters of land, now surrounded by a metal fence and off-limits to him. Murad Shetvi, head of the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission of the Northern West Bank, and a coordinator for unarmed resistance marches, told the Electronic Intifada that settlements have led to the confiscation of thousands of dönems of agricultural land in the Salfit governorate. The entire area of the governorate is about 26,000 dönems, Shetvi said, with 11,000 located in Area A and under the Palestinian Authority, and 15,000 dönems are in Area C. A dönem is equivalent of 1,000 square meters. Salfit Governorate contains 25 Israeli settlements, Shetvi added, the largest of which is Ariel, which is built on land belonging to the villages of the area, including Kafar al-Dik and Al-Zawiya. The most dangerous settlement project in Salfit is the occupation's attempt to expand the Ariel settlement by establishing an industrial zone there and linking it to a settlement that is being planned in the Ras area and Khalat Hassan area west of Salfit. Ahmad al-Mahmoud also built a hut on his land. In fact, it was built several times because the Israeli regime military kept demolishing it. The latest demolition was in September 2020. He rebuilt it less than 2 months later. Today, the hut is multifunctional, including as a recreational place for his family and grandchildren. Settler attacks increase more during the harvest seasons, Al-Mahmoud told the Electronic Intifada, adding, especially the olive harvest. Settler gangs prepare themselves for the September-November harvest by cutting down olive trees and stealing their fruits. And it is not just Palestinians who are targets. Settlers have been known to target foreign and Israeli activists when these have turned up to protect farmers for the harvest, pelting them with stones or assaulting them with clubs. Al-Mahmoud does not only have to contend with direct assaults, he told the Electronic Intifada. When the Zionist regime in administrative control over the area, he has yet to receive permission to dig a water well for irrigation purposes. He still has to rely on trucks carrying water tanks to irrigate his trees once a week.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK Chancellor has unveiled a new budget to tackle soaring inflation and the cost of living crisis. But will his plan work? It's supposed to fill a £54 billion black hole in the UK government budget. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at that budget, which is called austerity by many circumstances, see if it is feasible or just projection-based, and also whether the Chancellor's much-dreaded austerity program will help UK's economy, which is projected to face the worst recession on record. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Former member of the British Parliament, Lembit Opik, joins us from London. Also joining us is journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, welcome, gentlemen. Let me first start with you, Lembit Opik, if I may. We are taking a look at a budget that right off the bat has been called an austerity budget. And taking a look at the definition of what austerity is, it fits all of it. Policies that are considered an increase in taxes, cutting back on government programs like health care services, aid to veterans, maybe a reduction in pensions, reduction in salaries, although the reduction in pensions is not mentioned. Why is it called an austerity package, you think?
Because it's a familiar phrase. But what you could call it is a disaster package. When it comes down to it, when you have an overheating economy, you increase taxes and you increase inflation rates, sorry, you increase things to reduce inflation, but you also increase things like interest rates. If you have a weak economy, then you reduce those things. This budget is neither. We've got a situation now where we've got a £2 trillion economy with roughly a £2 trillion deficit. But the fundamental problem here is, as far as I can see, that Rishi Sunak has to put right what successive governments have done wrong for many years. What does this mean in practical terms, in not economic terms? The poor will pay much more in their taxes. The rich will as well, but they can afford it. So we live in a situation now where the United Kingdom, the sixth biggest economy in the world, is punishing the poor for the mistakes of politicians. And that's something I would never have voted for when I was an MP.
So are we looking at the party itself to have failed successive economic policies, perhaps, Fra Hughes? I mean, this one in particular, couldn't say it better based on a headline that said just about everyone is going to pay more taxes. Tax rises for all. Looking at £55 billion belt tightening measures due to these tax rises. Is that an accurate description?
I think it is, yes, 100%. I think for a lot of people, they hear the word, you know, everyone knows what tax raises actually mean, more money taken out from the public, from people's disposable income after they've paid for everything else, their mortgage, their housing rent, their food, their fuel. And austerity is just a word that people, like, vaguely know stuff about. So in order to kind of see if this is an austerity budget and where it's going to take us in the future, I just took the liberty of writing down a few notes from a book that was written on Tory austerity. It's called The Lost Decade, and it covers the years 2010 to 2020. Now, apparently, there are more food banks in Britain than there are McDonald's. 600,000 children have fallen back into relative poverty. Life expectancy has shortened. One in five girls and young women are cutting, burning, or poisoning themselves. Infant mortality rates have risen for the first time in two generations. The public realm is employing a smaller proportion of the workforce than it has done since 1945. 25% of all local government jobs no longer exist. Two-thirds of children in poverty have at least one parent working. Theresa May said in 2018 austerity had ended. Yet in real terms, job salaries for many have remained stagnant for over a decade. Nurses, firemen, postal workers and rail workers are either on strike or about to go on strike. And while many European governments have renationalized the energy companies, what Britain declared yesterday was that they were going to spend £5.8 billion building more ships. So what we have is a further removal of wealth from the poor to the rich through this agenda. And it proves that Rishi Sunak, the present British Prime Minister, when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, his assets and those of his wife and his family were supposed to be more than £700 million, which was more than the £600 million that the Queen was supposed to have had as her kind of disposable income or money, right, that she could reach as an asset. So Rishi Sunak's wife hasn't paid any tax. These people are so removed from the public domain that they have absolutely nothing in common with the poor of Britain.
Yeah, I don't think I heard what you said after all the statistics, because I was really just drowning in that. No, I did hear you, but I was so drowned, okay, into the severity and the shock factor of some of the points that you made there, which I'm tempted to ask you this question, Lempidopic, that the Conservatives should not even be up for voting. They should be eliminated if that's the type of output is coming out of the UK economy. Are we looking at failed economic policies from the Conservative Party, or is it more to the story, as if there was somebody else that was heading the ship, they would still fall flat like they did?
You asked me three questions. First of all, the Conservatives have completely messed up with the economy, which is the one thing that people used to vote for when they voted Conservative. Secondly, yes, successive governments have done that. This is the irony. The Labour Party and the Conservatives both made similar mistakes, leading to this meltdown. Remember that the 2008 meltdown was really under the leadership of the Labour Party. They didn't cause the global recession, but they did not protect against it. Thirdly, the biggest question that you ask, can anyone do better? Not at the moment, because Keir Starmer has no better solution than Rishi Sunak. At least, whether you like him or you don't like him, Jeremy Hunt is talking about these terribly difficult decisions. I would actually take a different economic philosophy. I studied economics at university. I was top of my class at school on this, so maybe I've got some qualification to talk about this. But Keir Starmer is not in any way credible. His position about creating a net zero national grid for electricity by 2030 is just ludicrous. He doesn't explain how he does anything. He doesn't really tell the rich or the poor what he's going to do about tax. So wherever you stand on the climate, wherever you stand on tax, nobody knows what Keir Starmer will do. And I suspect if he had a good story to tell, he'd tell it.
I think they don't have a clear-cut plan, do they? Limpid-Opic,
no.
In terms of what to do at this point. Let me ask you, Frahuz, the spokesperson, Rachel Reeves, said the government has forced our economy into a doom loop where low growth leads to higher taxes, lower investments, and squeezed wages with the running down of public services, all of which hits economic growth again. So that's what she has said. Your reaction to that, if you agree, and, of course, the fact that, as I asked Limpid-Opic, they don't have a clear-cut economic plan to present instead of what's being presented out there by Jeremy Hunt.
Well, I do agree with what Rachel has said. Maybe what I would add to it is, you know, it may be a vicious circle, but it could be broken at any time, because I am a strong believer in the redistribution of wealth, and that is the part of the problem here, that there is no fair distribution of wealth within the United Kingdom. I believe if tax avoidance was ended, that the national debt could be wiped out practically overnight. One-third of the billionaires in Britain have their money in tax havens and pay absolutely no tax. Many corporations do exactly the same. They avoid paying their tax, which is actually stealing public services from the people who are most in need. I don't believe that successive British governments have failed politically, or their policies have not brought about the economic boom that they claim to want for the people on the island of Britain. I believe that successively, from Margaret Thatcher on, they moved to privatise all the public utilities. They moved on to create wealth for companies at the expense of their workers. And then what we had after the crash and after 2010 was there was nothing else to privatise, there was nothing else to give away. So then they brought in austerity, which I believe the Tory government, every time it gets into power, wants to reduce public spending. It wants to send the people back into the Victorian age of the workhouse. And that's why we have food banks. That's why we have more children in poverty than ever before. And that's why mental health, homelessness, drug abuse, violence on the streets, and crime are all skyrocketing, because the government has taken away the safety net and the mental health security for the nation and have basically abandoned the people in order to finance the rich and to continue with the war effort with these new ships at the £5.8 billion that they're about to spend, which could be spent on the health service, could be spent in welfare payments, and could be spent creating housing and employment for the people of Britain.
When you talk about the redistribution of wealth, that's a very interesting point. It sounds easy enough for that to be redistributed in a sense. Technically, I'm not too sure. I don't have the knowledge of that. But aren't we looking at a deeper problem that the UK is suffering from? And that is that it's not the manufacturing type country that it used to be. And a lot of the services, especially in London, are focused on the financial services, for example. Is that one of the things that is ailing the UK as a whole?
Well, I would say the fact that Britain can no longer compete in the world when it comes to manufacturing, when you have China, India, Pakistan, and other subcontinent countries that can perform and outbid, outbuild, and in many cases, outprofit Britain. Under Margaret Thatcher, the coal industry was killed off, the steel industry was killed off, the trade union movement was decimated. And yes, Britain now is more a service country. The money does come in and out of the City of London, the financial sector. But that's all speculation. That's all shares. That's all people betting on where the economy is going to go, where interest rates are going to go. So there is no manufacturing base, and places like the north of England have been totally devastated. But that doesn't mean, I mean, Lambert said it's the sixth richest economy in the world. You can't tell me that there are multi-billionaires and yet you can't have money for an adequate health service or teach children in schools or give them school dinners, because austerity is a political choice. It is not an economic necessity. Therefore, all these policies are choices by the government. They are the wrong choices for the poor and they are the right charges for the rich. And that's why we see inequality grow day by day and hour by hour in one of the largest economies in the world.
One of the things that's very worrisome, given the economic climate, not just for the UK, Frahuis, I'm sure you're aware of other European countries that are suffering in their economies in one way or another. But when you take a look at the poor, they're the ones that are obviously going to suffer more. Now, Jeremy Hunt has promised, based on what he has unveiled, that public services is not going to be affected as much. He has provided funds for it. But when push comes to shove and the money has to be spent, there's got to be projections and tax cuts that are involved in that speculation, which then many are hoping to translate into reality. Do you think that public services are going to take a hit and not reap any benefits that is being promised at this point?
Well, every government claims that it puts more money into the health service than the previous government. But say you put in 1 billion, just to pick a random figure. If you say, well, we put in 1.1 billion into the health service, which is more than the previous government, when you take in the rise in the cost of services, of drugs, of pharmaceuticals, of prosthesis that are used in surgery, and the rise in cost in patient transport, wages for nurses and doctors when eventually they get pay raises. In real terms, this means all those public services are being decimated again day by day and hour by hour. They're falling by the wayside. And I wouldn't believe a word James Hunt said. I wouldn't believe a word Rishi Sunak said. I am old enough to have realized that these people are just soundbites who say something for 30 seconds or 60 seconds on the television in order to appease the public. They are giving, I think it's every home in Great Britain and Northern Ireland, £400 to defer against the energy costs. But instead of capping the energy rate, they are allowing that to continue, although they will reduce it until April next year. What they are doing is subsidizing yet again private profit from energy companies with public money, and they are giving people money to appease the public so that there are not major riots on the streets of Britain, which is a distinct possibility when you see what's happening in the rest of Europe. But as I say, without nationalizing the energy companies, it will be very difficult to help the people who are most affected by this downturn in the economy, rising rates, and the fact that the people who can least afford this are going to be hardest hit. And again, I don't think that the government cares much for those people, because quite a few of them don't vote for the Conservative Party, and none of them are donors.
Okay. Lumpet Opik is back with us. Lumpet Opik, I'm still trying to get over the Frahuis stat on how there are more food banks than McDonald's, but this particular example, I think, is something that needs to be highlighted, where it's a new source, it claims, to be of economic anxiety in the UK, and that is mortgages, and how after more than a decade of, I guess, low interest rates, people in the UK are suffering from, new homeowners especially, are suffering from the interest rate hikes, where one particular example, this particular person said she bought her first home, a one-bedroom in Croydon in South London, and then a year and a half later, she is bracing for a nearly 80% jump in her monthly mortgage payments. I mean, is that what we're looking at, and how can people then afford their mortgages?
Yes, all the above. I'm sorry, I've got some very bad regional problems tonight. Maybe this is an indication of the state of the United Kingdom, but the serious point you're making here is right. People's cost of living isn't going up by 80%. It can be going up by 200%. Many people have fixed rate mortgages at 1.7%. you don't have to understand the mathematics here, but if I say that they've gone up 6%, you can understand that it's gone up three times since they got their mortgage. So if they were paying £500 a month in the past, they'll be paying £1,500 a month. Then you add the fact that they're going to be paying maybe £2,000 a year extra in terms of their energy costs, and the food has gone up by a couple of £1,000. Britain is bankrupt. We're insolvent. And this is the sixth biggest country in the world. It used to claim to be the second fastest growing or the fastest growing. Everything that my colleague there has said is right. At the end of the day, we're in a situation where we are in crisis Britain, not promising Britain. And Rishi Sunak has approved an increase in taxes, which will hurt the poor the most. Where do we go from here? Well, there's nothing wrong with the situation that a miracle wouldn't fix. But that's what it will take to get Britain out of its current mess.
Okay, thank you for that. Lempit Opik, we do appreciate it. Former member of the British Parliament there talking to us from London. And I'm going to come to you now, Frahiz, with what the Bank of England has warned that the UK is facing its longest recession on record, and economic downturn is expected to extend well into 2024. Now, the rising interest rates is one of the reasons that is a double-edged sword, because you have to tame inflation. But at the same time, when you have the interest rates rise, you can't give out, I mean, you can give out loans, but the higher rate dissuades, is not that attractive for people to take out, whether it's for businesses, homes, et cetera. Are we looking at a downturn that's predicted that this new budget can then face with this type of stat coming out from the Bank of England based on what they've presented?
Well, I don't think the budget that's being put forward is in any way going to have an effect, in my mind, for the interest rates going forward. A lot of this is this recession that's going to go into 2024. We've all been here before. It's a capitalist boom and bust system. Even the Bible said there were 7 years of lean and 7 years of fat. If you take the financial crisis of 2008, which was brought about by the deregulation of the banks, that's why that came about. There was no kind of fiscal pressure put on the banks, and they just kind of ran away with people's money and ran away with their own ideas of how to create more profit. You're right, it's a catch-22. Whenever interest rates go up, then the cost of borrowing becomes more expensive. Therefore, businesses that are in trouble won't be able to get access to more finance. People who are considering opening a business or starting a business won't have access to the finance because they won't be able in the short term to pay back the high repayments. Then you have mortgages that may default, and people could possibly become homeless and their houses seized and people put out onto the streets. But for my mind, and I'm not an economist, but I believe a lot of this is just pure profiteering from the companies, the profiteering from the energy sector, the profiteering from the food sector, the profiteering from everything and everywhere and everyone. They're just all these companies and corporations using the excuse of inflation and the war in Ukraine to just stick their arm into the public purse and stick their arms into the pockets of the members of the public in order to make obscene profits. So if they found a way to stop this obscene profiteering, then there wouldn't be a need to increase interest rates. The reason why so much money is being spent in society right now is because everything has gone up in price, and a lot of people will be spending their savings just to stand still. So by increasing interest rates in order to slow down the amount of money that's being spent in the economy,
Right. The correct
way to do that is to stop the profiteering.
Yeah, I wish we had come up with this point earlier, because what you're saying then is they're taking advantage of the situation for whatever they can come up with, whether it's broken supply chains or what have you. Too bad we just don't have the time, but thank you very much for that. Frahiz, journalist, author, and activist. And we had Lempit Opik with us prior, former member of the British Parliament from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatway. It's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. So, dear listeners, we are talking about how the Holy Quran, the very word of Allah, can soften our hearts and how this softening of hearts relates to our ubudiyya. Now, what a beautiful and interesting discussion we have here on the program today. Of course, first and foremost, the Holy Quran, as we know, is a book which has been sent by Allah. It is a book which has not been changed. It is a divine book, of course. It has been sent by a messenger who did not speak out of his own whims or his own desires. Matter of fact, he spoke only out of divine inspiration and that which the Almighty Allah had him say. And so this book is one of the divine books that Allah has sent to mankind. We're talking